Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. August is simpatico with kindred birthdays, including my own, a collegial gaggle of Leos and a few Virgos. I start with David Horowitz, who is 77 years old tomorrow, August 17th. He is a professor emeritus at Portland State University, where he has taught history since 1968, which was the year I first got to know him, not at college, but in a favorite tavern of Portland hippie rabble, Rubens Five, owned by the late Don Petrie, who later opened an Italian restaurant in Newport. David is the author and co-author of many histories of cultural and political America, plus many articles about music that reflect his professorship of the jazz piano. A recent autobiography is based on his own learning and teaching history, Getting There, A Cultural Odyssey. I am now going to read what he says is his latest on future prospects, Looking Ahead, by David A. Horowitz, which he wrote this past August 6th. There is no doubt progressives and social justice activists are at a critical juncture, an existential crossroads, as we look to the country's political future with a fierce determination barely equaled in modern American history. Concerned social change advocates are attempting to return to the drawing board to erase the catastrophe of 2016 and prevent anything like its reoccurrence. The passions of this commitment are completely warranted and speak to the importance of the moment. Yet there is a danger of wanting something so badly that it overwhelms the powers of judgment with either a heady faith bolstered by unwarranted happy talk or unadulterated panic and defeatism. Neither response will be adequate to speak to the present crisis, which involves the ability of the American political system to survive as an organism in which policy and rational decision-making can lead to an improved life for its people and efforts, no matter how tentative, to heal and repair the world, quote unquote. In the meantime, several potential 2020 Democratic candidates and a segment of the base seem to be replicating the Karl Rove Trump strategy of voicing the sentiments of the party base as the prelude to a general election. In current parlance, this ranks as an example of getting ahead of one's skis. In electoral terms, it could spell disaster for the next presidential contest. One example comes in calls for the wonderfully sounding single-payer Medicare for all. Admittedly, it is extremely difficult to find balanced assessments of how the plan might be financed and how it would be implemented. But there are a few basic facts out there. The Bernie Sanders program would finance single payer, no insurance premiums or co-pays, with a 7.5% tax on employer payrolls over $2 million, a wealth tax on the richest 160,000 households, a tax on inherited wealth over $50 million, and a 4% income tax surcharge on families earning over $27,000. Yet, when Vermont considered a plan in 2014 that was not as generous, it figured it would have required 11.5% payroll tax on employers and a 9% income tax surcharge on each household. Some conservative think tanks estimate that taxpayer costs for single payer would be in trillions of dollars in the coming decade. These probably can be discounted. Yet assessing the financial burden of single payer is a source of public anxiety. For example, lowering costs would have to be essential for making the plan workable. Would physicians and other providers be willing to absorb reduced compensation, and how would their responses figure in chances of passing the bill in the first place? The Nation magazine's analyst points out that Canadian, Australian, French, and German systems were put in place when health costs were reasonably stable, so that it was easier to keep expenses in check than for the American system to reduce costs that are already escalated. Sanders insists increased taxes on families would be less than current insurance premiums. yet 70% of the American adult population is already covered by private or veterans insurance plans, and a third of seniors are enrolled in the privately administered Medical Advantage program. Would these people be willing to give up something they already have, despite its limitations, for an unknown quantity? Probably not, according to the way conservatives were able to manipulate anxiety surrounding the transition to the Affordable Health Care Act. Yes, one survey indicates a plurality, some 47%, of approval for Medicare for All, without acknowledgement of the costs of the plan. The problem is indicated by a Democratic-sponsored poll that found that working-class swing voters are suspicious of single-payer as either unrealistic, increasing their taxes, or shifting resources from existing programs. Apart from that survey, fiscal conservatives worry that the plan would bloat the $400 plus billion annual federal budget deficit the country has experienced since 2008. The same poll of working-class swing voters, how do you spell the Midwest, found an equal amount of skepticism toward the $15 an hour minimum wage, apparently based on its, quote, unrealistic chances. But perhaps the most telling response to the survey was opposition to the free public college tuition proposal several progressive candidates have been floating. The pollster advised the party to drop it from its agenda. In a nation in which only a third of adults have a college education, this is not an unreasonable finding. The survey reported that working-class swing voters saw the idea as elitist because they feared they would be paying for other people's free education through higher taxes, while they would be stuck for their own education costs through higher fees or taxes. Instead, they told pollsters they wanted greater emphasis on job training, reduction of higher ed debt for graduates, and more affordable colleges. It is instructive to remember that although college-educated voters constituted half the electorate for the first time in 2016, Trump's road to the White House had a lot to do with winning 51% of non-college voters. Pointing to the dynamics of the 2004, 2012, and 2016 presidential elections, one analyst has concluded that, quote, working-class voters are less apt to support candidates they view as elitist, regardless of party, unquote. The difficulty of universalizing the pet projects of Democratic progressives points to the challenges of returning to majority status. Pandering to the educated cosmopolitan base will not be sufficient in building that elusive electoral college victory, because politics is about coalitions. The trick involves a transcendent vision for the country that is inclusive and forward-looking while remaining accessible to a winning combination of the electorate. Politics is an art form that requires a lightness on one's feet, not a heavy march to a predetermined goalpost. You just don't collect the 51% of votes you need and then proceed to bring your agenda to fruition without a complex process that involves compromise and occasional backtracking. You may say things to your base that gratify their hearts, but in the end have nothing to do with your ability to make it come true. Break up the banks. And in the end, the consequences of such banter are devastating, leaving to the disillusionment of your followers and a general cynicism about the political system and government itself, which, of course, fits right into the conservative playbook. On the other hand, the proposal swing voters advanced about job training, college costs, and student debt instead of free tuition fit beautifully into a progressive agenda. How about saving the Affordable Care Act by increasing the premium subsidies to working families? And yes, financing that with restoration of some of the taxes on wealthy households. How about an immigration policy that combines resources for border security with humane treatment and pathways to citizenship? Even firearm safety measures, as just about everyone knows, are within the realm of possibility, so long as they are articulated in the name of the common welfare. My plea is for a Democratic presidential candidate, most likely from the battleground Midwest, who can reach beyond the echo chamber and inspire both new voters and others with a positive call for change, with a healing and inclusive voice that doesn't alienate or frighten potential supporters, and is capable of reaching into a disaffected Republican suburban districts required for an electoral victory. No, it will not be enough to tap previously unregistered young or minority voters. This does not mean a dilution of workable progressive issues or programs. Look at Georgia Democrat Stacey Abrams, an African-American legislative leader whose inclusive call to bring together rural and urban voters in her state has put her ahead in polling to become the first Black female governor in U.S. history. Sometimes it's the voice and posture candidates adopt rather than specific policies, as long as those positions don't frighten voters or characterize the candidate, rightly or wrongly, as an elitist who sees themselves as superior to ordinary people. The stakes could not be more draconian. All of us need to get this right and show the discipline that allows us to leave the echo chamber. In the words of Theodore Roosevelt, nothing gets accomplished, quote, if we do not work through practical methods and with a readiness to face life as it is and not as we think it ought to be. Facing life as it is doesn't mean you can't have a vision of something better. It just means you have to start with what you have and move on from there. And that was by David Horowitz, Looking Ahead, whose birthday, whose 77th birthday, is tomorrow, August 17th. And now, this is when I intrude my own birthday, this Sunday, August 19th, which makes David Horowitz 2 days my elder, both of us born pre-Pearl Harbor in 1941. With exception of a brain drain nearly at flood stage, I think, on the feather edge of 77, that I am yet avoiding Al's hammer. But a realistic assessment of blundering through two back-to-back palindromic years of two centuries, 1991 and 2002, which happens only at changes of millennia, I am quickly closing in on the cusp of obituary. I have survived a war I regret being involved in half a century ago. I returned stateside on my 26th birthday. And I am concerned by a possible nuclear holocaust, as well as the imminent anthropopathetic mutilation of Gaia into a hostile planet, obviously a quandary far beyond my miniature awareness. Every one of my family who preceded me are dead, except for my favorite cousin and first best friend, whose 78th birthday was yesterday, August 15th. She has been matriarch of our succeeding lineage since my mother died 10 years ago at age 95. I feel that my cousin and I are at the outer rim of our heredity. I would like to round out my life to a full century, or at least a 95 like our mother, but my sister chides me that women live longer than men, yet grants the possibility I might survive to our father's age, which was 84 when he died 20 years ago. I am a half-breed, Sicilian-Irish, straight up the middle. Whiskey and wine, I proudly boast. Bologna and Bellarney, friends retort. I am the grandchild of Sicilian immigrants and farther back of Irish immigrants who flooded into the USA in the mid-19th century as a result of a lack of potatoes. The current misanthropic and white supremacist endeavor to curtail immigration is like stopping water. People have been flowing all over this planet since the earliest humanoids dropped out of trees in Africa, those vilified dunghole countries so rapidly spurned by xenophobic anti-immigrant deracinators whose own ancestors were immigrants, either fleeing persecution or retribution. One American Black man phoned public media and said that he was a recipient of chained migration. A wonderful analogy. I have a few persistent liabilities other than Latin-Gaelic crossbreeding, primary among them that I was born left-handed. I was also born Catholic, and being left-handed damned me as a child of Satan, according to nuns and priests, which was a sacrilege they attempted to cure by forcing me to be on the right side of God. They did not succeed, instead defining for me at a primary level the unremitting struggle between left, bad, and right, good, as well as demonstrating the ruthless cruelty of righteousness. My most enduring vision of prejudice and tyranny is a nun with a ruler slapped across an offending left wrist. So now, a leftist diatribe that might be considered turgid and certainly polemic that I wrote a while back for my defunct left-wing newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, that I titled Children of Satan, which I am to read right now. I am left-handed, which is easier to be than in the past. Catholic nuns vigorously attempted to make me right-handed when I started school and accused me of being a son of Satan when I refused. I don't know why most people are right-handed, because they are. The right hand is the hand of sustenance and labor, and the vile left hand began its evil reputation in ancient times when it was used to clean away the body's excrement. Thus, from antiquity has developed a sophisticated aversion to the left side of things. Prejudice against people who are left-handed predates more familiar bigotries of race, religion, nationality, gender, and homophobia. In every culture before record, all that is good and righteous has been accorded the right hand, while everything evil, ugly, wrong-headed, or simply bad luck is the left. In politics, as well as society, a crude bicameral cleft is made between right and left. The established order that resists change is the political and cultural right, which usually defends itself with tradition, religion, and autocratic power. The political left is the force of change and reform that calls upon the future instead of the past and explores new ideas and innovative social and political approaches to greater freedom and well-being of the common citizenry. Left is about justice, not privilege. The oldest struggle after survival is for freedom, of being a part of a community, not enslaved by it. The internal pitiless struggle between haves and have-nots, the despairing rage of those condemned to live bitterly wretched lives in the shadows and as menials to the economically and politically aristocratic elite, who are in their turn angrily terrified by this rage. History shrieks with the pain of injustice, only briefly muffled by excesses of gross brutality. Sometimes the oppressed overthrow or forcibly reform their lords and bosses, but elites always rise in even the most originally classless societies. If the American Revolution is accepted as more than a revolt of colonial bourgeoisie, and that it gave birth to an essentially egalitarian society in which the common citizenry has a chance to be their own rulers, it should also be realized that every reform has been bitterly and often bloodily fought and adopted only with great reluctance. Reforms that have been adopted are usually countered with vicious backlash. For all the problems Western democracies have had with communism and socialism, words that mean community and society when stripped of ideological abstraction, the ideas at their roots grew as alternatives to rapid industrialization in the 19th century, demanding in philosophy, if not practice, more than servitude for the mushrooming working classes as their share for producing the technological revolution throughout Western Europe and North America. Fascism and Nazism is an extreme right-wing reaction to these leftist heresies of class, i.e. social and political parity. That communist and socialist societies generally become totalitarian states of the political right should not repudiate the underlying perception shared with the democracies themselves, flawed and corrupt, that there is enough for everyone and everyone is equal under law. Reform, resistance, and rebellion to contemporary rule in the United States has since at least the Russian Revolution been called by assaulted authority leftist, a sinister, from Latin, sinus, meaning left or unlucky, hint at Bolshevik conspiracy, a suspicion of alien agents or homegrown dupes of foreign strategies to destroy the American way of life operating within its very heart. In other words, dissent and resistance to authority and or injustice in this land of liberty and justice is implied to be treachery. Perhaps because of ancient and immediate hostility toward left-handed people, we are usually supporters of underdogs and outcasts and feel personally sympathetic to ideals of personal and political liberty. Left-handed people share with women and minority races and religions, not to mention people with physical and mental handicaps, the problems of survival in a world designed with no consideration for their presence in it, or much worse, designed to eradicate their presence. And that was something I wrote, Children of Satan. And now I wish to read a poem I wrote on the 50th anniversary of VJ Day, August 14th, 1995, for and about my lifetime amorata, Julie Concepcion, who was born that same day, that same Victory Over Japan Day in 1945. Julie and VJ Day. You might have been named Victoria Jane. You knew a girl who was. Poor girl, you said. You are 50, VJ Day, the day you were born. The World War ended. Millions dead, gone. Never more forever. You are new life, born amidst burial. A sad world you make warm. You unconditional mother, you wonderful woman, I love you always. Julie is now 73 this past August 14th. She is not only a left-handed pariah like me, she is also a crossbreed like me, half German and half Filipina. Her Filipino father was an immigrant, her mother a Midwest farm girl. And Julie's oldest granddaughter, Winter, who was 15 on August 5th, and a magnificent horsewoman who is busy this summer competing in various Northwestern state and county fairs, is an excellent living example of diversity. She is Nordic, Germanic, European, Black, African American, and Pacific Island Asian, all blended into a splendid American girl. And now, a couple of poems from my niece, Tracy Ann McCusker, who turned 35 August 8th. She is eligible to be president of the USA. And I'd like to read a poem from her first book, Letters from Nowhere. This is by Tracy. August 21st. We stand together in the room without balloons or guests. He clasps his arms around the shoulders and I wrap mine around the waist. He juts like flint into my stomach. Words rot in my mouth. It could have been a tall, clean stranger who stole this hug. We'd draw up under an awning, licks of hot coffee and cigarettes intruding from the street. Asking for directions to the metro, he'd knot his body around me. Blood in my fingers, bashing against my skin like pebbles. We would unravel to catch a train, hail a taxi to Place du Concorde. Hugging air, I stand apart. A gray streak of hair mats hard to his skin. I look at the face of my watch. It is too late to be strangers. And that was from Letters from Nowhere. And now another poem from her second book of poetry, Manifesto for All by Tracy McCusker. Manifesto. Where is the opposition, not decried by power? Where is the branding reproach against reactionaries? Two things. One, acknowledge power. Two, publish this nursery tale. Sketch to this end. And the manifesto. A specter is haunting power, the specter of opposition. To this end, assemble. And many years ago, Tracy wrote something that probably could describe Trump. The facts, although interesting, are irrelevant. And as I said, she's now 35 and eligible for the presidency. Well, Sunday, August 19th is not only my birthday, but it is also the start of KMUN's annual fall pledge drive, a very public and personal economic transfusion from private persons who appreciate community endeavor. So anybody who might even remotely think of gifting my natality, I ardently urge you to contribute instead to Coast Community Radio as either a veteran or a recruit member. Or you can donate to KMUN in the names of a few notable Augustinians, such as Judy Nyland, godmother of Shanghai and Astoria, whose birthday is Saturday, August 18th. Or Jesse Torres, chef emeritus of the immortal Ship Inn, which had earlier been the fabled Mermaid Tavern. His birthday was August 10th. Or Tom Hanlon, longtime legislator for Clatsop County, whose birthday is August 21st. He is now a true sea lawyer, practicing maritime law and perhaps still working on fish boats. Or Cher Venera, born August 20th. Her family restaurant is the Oyster Bar in Portland, and she was a great poet. Or you might wish to pledge in the names of the Duffel twins, Lily and Donna Joy, whose birthday is August 22nd. Lily has been prominent in Shanghai in Astoria. Or the third twin, Lee Miller, whose birthday is also August 22nd. He is homeless in Portland, a refugee from the recent tsunami of coastal gentrification. Or perhaps even for perennial unofficial Oregon poet laureate Walt Curtis, who is a July 4th baby, born like David Horowitz and me 77 years ago in 1941. Whoever you wish to pledge for, in your own name, of course, and for whichever KMUN program or programmer besides the aforementioned Augustians, pledge for liberty, pledge for justice, pledge for First Amendment media, pledge for free range radio KMUN. This is Michael McCusker.